Hi, folks. This is Bob Main, and welcome to another episode of today's Survival Show, helping you do what you can with what you have, wherever you are. I believe this is episode 167, but as usual, I'm coming to you from my mobile studio, my Honda Accord, while I'm driving down the freeway headed out to a business appointment. So I'm going to make sure that I'm practicing safe driving and podcasting, and I'm not going to get on the internet with my iPhone to check to see what episode this is. When you download it, you'll figure it out because it'll be properly labeled. Okay, but thanks again for tuning in. This is a practical show. As most of you know, I don't go tinfoil hat on you because I don't believe in that stuff. I try to keep things practical and rooted in common sense. I'm going to talk about fight or flight in this episode. You've probably heard that terminology before, right? Someone's gone into fight or flight mode. Well, have you ever wondered what that means? Have you ever kind of pondered in your mind, well, what do they mean by fight or flight? What happens to the body and what happens to the mind when somebody goes into the fight or flight response? Well, I'm going to examine that in this episode, and I've also got some listener feedback that has come to me recently that I'd like to cover as well. So let me say that, first of all, my email address, if you want to send me comments, is bob@todayssurvival.com. bob@todayssurvival.com. I also want to let you know the main website address, todayssurvival.com. There's two S's in that web address, todayssurvival.com. If you'd like to join our forum, there's been a lot of people requesting to get on our forum. You have to request to get on our forum. I'm trying to keep the spammers out. Do me a favor. If you register for our forum, please send me an email as soon as you get done registering. Send me an email, tell me who you are, and tell me what your username is, and I'll approve your account as quickly as possible. It's the best way I can keep all the ridiculous amount of spammers out of the forum. But we'd like to have you part of our group. We've got a nice internet group, a good forum. People talk about good practical ideas. We keep the personal attacks down to almost nothing, and we keep the mindless stuff down to almost nothing. There's a lot of really good people on the forum. To all of you who are on the forum who listen to the show, thank you very much for all your contributions. We have a nice little internet group, and it's growing slowly, and I'd like to invite you to become a member of that. Also, if you'd like to support my show and help out the efforts that I do here, there are costs associated. I actually do two podcasts. I do this one, and then I do the Handgun World show. And it takes time, it takes resources, it takes bandwidth, it takes equipment here and there, and that would be much helpful. I do have a special premium podcast that I release only to members of my Survival Champions Club. And it's only $15. You can go to todayssurvival.com. You can click a link there that says buy now, and you can get your copy of a special podcast. I do not cover that information on this regular free podcast that I do right here. But if you'd like to take advantage of that, go to todayssurvival.com, and I'll send you an email as to how to get that podcast. All right, that's it. I don't like this show to be real commercial, so let's go ahead and dive right into the main topic, which is the fight or flight response. Now, there's an excellent article I read that I'm going to base this on. An excellent article by Neil Niemark, Dr. Neil Niemark. And I'll put a link in the show notes and also on the forum. So I was talking about our forum earlier. I like to put the links for all the shows in the forum, because in that way it's much easier to talk about them. I love the comments that come directly to the podcast website. But also, if you don't mind, if you are a member of our forum, putting it on there, I'd appreciate that, because it makes it much easier to discuss it and so forth. So check for the link to this article on the forum. So what is the fight or flight response? Well, according to Dr. Niemark, it's the body's primitive, automatic, inborn response that prepares you to either fight or flee from a perceived attack or a perceived harm or threat that's coming to you, typically in a physical nature. However, sometimes our fight or flight response is triggered by non-physical threats, and I'm going to talk about that coming up a little bit towards the end of this show. But that's kind of the fight or flight response. It's kind of your body's own primitive, automatic, inborn instinct. Okay? But what happens when you do get under excessive stress? And the reason I'm talking about this is because, let's face it, if disaster strikes, I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's a weather disaster. I don't care if it's some kind of an attack, God forbid. You know, and a lot of people think that survivalism only comes into play when something major happens. See, I disagree with that philosophy. I think survivalism is an everyday lifestyle. I think it's an everyday practice. Because every day something threatens our survival. And I don't mean our life and death survival, but I think every day we're challenged by outside influences. We might be challenged by bosses. We might be challenged by personal relationships. We might be challenged with a problem that happens to your dwelling, or a problem that happens to your car, or something that happens to you while you're on the job. You could be challenged even by general emotions that take place. There's all kinds of things that can challenge us, and I really believe the more that we can learn to mitigate the everyday stuff, the easier it's going to be for us if a major disaster does happen. Would you agree with me on that? The more you do little by little each day, slowly but surely, to prepare, the easier it's going to be to mitigate the problems that might occur after there's a major disaster. And, you know, today with our economy here in the United States, people losing their job is a major disaster. Every day, the stink hits the fan for somebody. Did you know that? Every day, somebody is experiencing a stink hit the fan event. It could be the loss of a job. It could be the loss of a relative, unfortunately. But those things happen. And I've been through them. I've lost parents and I've lost grandparents suddenly when they're not expected. And, ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you, the crap hits the fan for somebody every day. So what happens to us when we're under excessive stress? When we experience that, whether it's internal worry or whether it's an external circumstance, a bodily reaction is triggered. It is called the fight or flight response. It was originally discovered by Harvard psychologist Walter Cannon. And it's a response that's hardwired into our brains. There's really not much that we can do about it, but we can recognize when it's happening to us. And it kind of represents a genetic wisdom that's designed to protect us from bodily harm. And it usually corresponds to an area of our brain called the hypothalamus. And when that's stimulated, it initiates a sequence of nerve cell firing and a chemical release that prepares our body to either run or to fight. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit more detail as well. But again, it's ingrained in us. It's hardwired into our brains. It's sort of a genetic wisdom. It's something that, you know, that God gave us. He gave us that ability to handle when we're under excessive stress. Now, again, it can come in the form of a physical problem, somebody trying to attack you, and it can come in the form of a non-physical problem, which can result in an emotional fight or flight response. I'll be getting into that a little bit later. It's important that we understand what the signs are. What are the signs that your fight or flight response is getting stimulated or getting activated? Let's talk about that. When our fight or flight response does get activated, there's a sequence of nerve cell firing that goes on. And your body starts to release chemicals like adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol. And your body starts to release those into the bloodstream. And these patterns of nerve cell firing and the chemical release cause your body to undergo a series of big-time changes, folks. Your respiratory rate, your breathing rate starts to go up. The blood in your body starts to get shunted away from your digestive tract, and it's directed to your muscles and limbs. That's why sometimes you read stories about people that have superhuman strength, or they experience strength that they've never had before because they're in that fight or flight mode. And that blood is directed more towards their muscles and the limbs, and the adrenaline and the noradrenaline and the cortisol that's released into your bloodstreams gives people the ability to do that when they normally can't perform physically like that. Okay? Another thing that happens is your pupils start to dilate. Your awareness starts to intensify. Your sight, your ability to see things gets much greater when you're in that fight or flight mode. And a lot of people report, boy, I tell you what, my visual acuity was incredible. I was able to see things that I couldn't see. Oftentimes when they're debriefed and they're forced to recall the specifics of the event from a fight or flight mode, they say that their awareness intensifies, their sight got better, their impulses get quicker, your reactions get quicker, and your perception of pain goes down. Most people are able to handle pain a lot greater when they're in that fight or flight mode. Your immune system mobilizes. It starts to activate intensely. You become prepared. You start to get ready physically and psychologically for the fight. Or for the flight, or to flee. And you can scan and search your environment to look for your enemy. You can scan and search a lot easier. Now, a couple of other important things to know on the signs of this happening. When your fight or flight system is activated, you start perceiving things in your environment as a possible threat. So, just about everything. If you're in that fight or flight mode, just about everything that you see, you're going to go, oh man, that's a threat. That's a threat to your survival because you're in that state. You're in that mental state. Even though something may not be a threat to your survival, you might perceive it as a threat. So by its very nature, the fight or flight system, it bypasses your rational mind. Your rational thought goes out the window, folks. That's why you hear so many stories about people's rational thought going out the window. They're in that fight or flight mode. It's a natural thing. You can't avoid it. You know, it's very difficult. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit later in this show about some things you can do when you recognize that you're in fight or flight mode that will help you. But it does bypass your rational mind. It bypasses that place in your brain where calmness exists, where well-thought-out beliefs actually exist, and it puts you into attack mode. And this kind of an alert state causes us to start to perceive almost everything around us as a possible threat to our survival. So what happens is we tend to start looking at everything and everybody as the enemy. You know, it's kind of like airport security, although I'm starting to bring up a subject here that gets my blood boiling because I do a lot of traveling and a lot of flying. But, you know, think about the TSA. Think about the airport security. It's kind of like when there's a heightened terrorist threat or when we've just had, if you think back to the times, it's been a while since we've had a terrorist attack on U.S. soil, a major terrorist attack. But it's kind of like airport security during that time. They're looking at everybody, hopefully, as a possible danger. They're looking at everybody as a possible person that could do someone harm. Even though, and I know that this doesn't sit well with people, even though they start treating little old ladies and kids as possible threats, and it irritates us, unfortunately what happens is if a major event occurs and it stimulates their fight-or-flight response, the security personnel begin to act that way. Now, you might say, yeah, Bob, but guess what? A lot of them are doing that when there has been no event that puts them into fight-or-flight mode. Yes, you're correct, and that is a big problem. But I use that as an example to kind of illustrate what might happen if there is somebody in a fight-or-flight mode. They tend to overreact at the slightest little comment. You ever have that happen to you? You ever have that happen to you when you're in a heated discussion? Maybe it's with a family member. Maybe it's with a coworker. Maybe it's with a friend. Maybe it's with a spouse. Maybe it's with a brother or a sister. People that are in fight or flight, every little slightest comment, whoa, boy, they're in overreaction mode. Can you relate to that? And their fear gets exaggerated. And their thinking gets distorted. This is what causes a lot of problems, is when their thinking gets distorted. Because people, when they're in that fight or flight state, tend to do irrational things that they wouldn't normally do. So if you wonder sometimes, why does somebody just snap? Right? You ever read news reports about somebody that just snapped? They just went off the deep end. It doesn't mean it makes it right what they did. They went off the deep end. They hurt somebody, killed somebody, destroyed something. Whatever. It doesn't make it right. And they did know right from wrong, but they snapped because they're in that fight or flight mode. They overreact. Their fear is exaggerated. Their thinking is severely distorted. And they see everything through a filter of possible danger. Now, I'm talking about this psychological stuff. It kind of reminds me of Cody Lundeen. You know, Cody Lundeen has often said that survival is 85 or 90% psychological. You know, and if you read that man's books, if you read Cody Lundeen's books, and if you watch his YouTube videos, and if you watch the TV show Dual Survival, where he and Dave Canterbury get together, and they pretty much do some amazing things. A lot of it is due to their will to survive, their psychological will. Now, they know a lot. Obviously, their skills are immense, and what they know. And see, there's a perfect example of stuff that I say all the time when I say, what you know is just as important as what you have. I really believe when it comes to survival, when it comes to common sense survival, I'm not talking about defending against the zombie apocalypse and stuff like that, that tinfoil hat stuff. I'm talking about common sense survival. I think that what you know is just as important as what you have. What's in your brain and what you know how to do can be just as important as what you have. Now, you might say, well, Bob, you might know a lot, but if you don't have any supplies to work with, you're kind of screwed. Yeah, that's true. But if you have a whole bunch of supplies to work with and you don't know how to use them, you're also kind of screwed. Or if you don't know innovative ways to use them, if you don't know alternative uses and things like that, you're also kind of screwed. So the two go hand in hand. Just don't discount your knowledge and don't discount your psychological ability. People can do amazing things when they put their mind to it. Now, the problem is psychologically, when someone's in fight or flight mode, sometimes fear is the lens that they use to see the whole world. All of a sudden, everybody is to be feared. That's not a good thing either. And unfortunately, it's almost impossible sometimes for people to have positive attitudes and positive beliefs when they're stuck in that fight-or-flight survival mode. Their heart's not open, their rational mind is disengaged, their consciousness is focused on fear, they're making it hard for themselves to make good, clear choices and recognize the consequences of their choices and so forth. And they're so focused on short-term survival and not the long-term consequences of their beliefs and choices that that's when problems occur. And when people are overwhelmed with excessive stress, their life becomes a series of short-term emergencies. All of a sudden, you know, we talk about emergencies a lot. I talk about it a lot on this podcast. And those of you who get on the forum, you talk a lot about emergencies. Well, some people make everything an emergency. Some people may turn everything into a short-term emergency. Oh my God, this is an emergency. The problem is they don't know how to get out of that fight or flight mode. Sometimes it's important to be in it. Yes. Sometimes if your life is in danger, if someone's about to attack you, yeah. Going into that fight or flight mode's a good thing because all of a sudden you're able to accomplish things that you can't normally accomplish. However, if you don't know how to get out of that and you're always in fight or flight, then everything becomes a short-term emergency. Everything becomes a disaster, a short-term disaster. And then that's when the irrational thought starts to take over. And people lose the ability to relax. They live from crisis to crisis. They thrive on chaos. I'm sure you've heard that, right? There's an old saying, I won't use a cuss word here. I'll replace a cuss word with something that's not a cuss word. But there's an old saying that crap stinks, but it's warm. Do you know someone like that? The crap stinks, but it's warm. It's familiar to them. And that's a sad existence, folks. But they thrive on chaos. They thrive on the crap. they thrive on the garbage in their life because that's all they know. It might stink, it might be revolting, but it's warm, it's familiar. And unfortunately, that's a psychological problem, and it seems like, to me, the people who think that way, that always subject themselves to crap in their life, just because it's warm and it's familiar, they've got a problem. They don't know how to get out of the fight or flight mode. They're the kind of people where everything is an emergency. Everything is a short-term emergency and a short-term crisis. And what happens is burnout is inevitable. And burnout can cause good things and bad things. Sometimes the bad thing burnout causes is people just quit. They just quit and they really screw their life up. Now, the positive is that burnout can be a motivation for people to change their lives for the better. Now, I'm going to talk about how to get out of the fight or flight and how to recognize when it might be harming you. Now, to understand that, Dr. Niemark makes a good point in this article. To understand what to do with your fight or flight, it's important to know what it's really designed to protect you from. And he says that our fight or flight response is designed to protect us from that proverbial saber-toothed tiger. You know, the saber-toothed tigers that once lurked in the woods and the fields. Now, most of us aren't threatened by them, but that's a good analogy, okay? Those tigers threaten your physical survival. So, in those cases, when you have your physical survival threatened, as in the case as if you're about to be attacked by a tiger, sometimes there's no greater response to have on your side than the fight or flight mode. You know, you've seen stories of mothers lifting cars off of their trapped children, or firemen heroically running into blazing houses and doing amazing things to save endangered victims because they're in that fight or flight mode and those chemicals are released into their system and they're able to do superhuman things. The surge of adrenaline, it enables people to do heroic acts and have incredible courage at times. But what are the saber-toothed tigers of today? What are those tigers of today? How are they disguised and why are they dangerous? It's important to know this because, you know, if you agree with me that survival is an everyday task, that survival is really something that we never really accomplish completely. It's a journey. It's a constant journey. We never get there, folks. What we do is we continually, day by day, improve our ability to handle what might come our way. Now, someday there's going to be a disaster that ends it all for you. It's called death. I'm sorry. It's something people don't like to think about. It's something I don't like to think about. I'll admit that. I try to stay grounded and rooted in my faith so that I know where I'm going to end up if God calls me home. And that's a chore. That's a tough one. That's a daily struggle, folks, but it's a daily struggle I want to undertake. And it's something that I undertake every day. And so it's something that I make a big part of my life. But today's saber-toothed tigers, the way that they disguise themselves, it can be in a lot of different ways. Rush hour traffic, nasty bosses, financial problems, bouncing a check, not having enough money to pay the bills, not having enough money to know where your next meal is coming from, having an argument with your boss or with your spouse or with a sibling, or you get into a vehicle accident, or road rage, or a sick kid, or a kid that gets harmed. These are saber-toothed tigers in disguise. And they may not be a threat to our physical survival, but they're there. And sometimes they're there on a daily basis. And nonetheless, they will also trigger or activate your fight or flight system at times. And it'll duplicate as if it was a physical threat to you. And on a daily basis, toxic stress hormones flow into our bodies for events that really don't pose any threat to our physical survival, but nonetheless, those toxic hormones do get released. And once that's been triggered, here's a question to ponder. What is the natural conclusion of our fight or flight response? See, here is where the problem can lie sometimes for people. And again, this article by Dr. Niemark is so good. You got to read it in its entirety, because I'm not going to cover the entire article. I don't have time to do that. But by its very design, the fight-or-flight response leads us to either fight or flee, both creating immense amounts of muscle movement and physical exertion. Now, has it ever become counterproductive? Let's examine that, because I think it has. In most cases today, once the fight-or-flight response is activated, we cannot flee, we cannot fight. We cannot physically run from our perceived threats. When we're faced with modern-day saber-toothed tigers, we have to sit in our office and control ourselves. We have to sit in traffic and just deal with it. We have to sit there and listen to that relative who is really making you mad. You have to just deal with it because your spouse wants you to. We have to wait until the bank opens to go handle the bounced check. Or we have to call their automated 24-hour line. And we have to go through the pain of admitting that we didn't manage our money and we got to take care of it. And we have to deal with it. So unfortunately, a lot of the major stressors that people go through today trigger a complete and full activation of their fight or flight response. And it causes them to become aggressive. And it causes them to become hypervigilant and overreactive. And this aggressiveness and overreaction and hypervigilance causes you to act or respond in ways that tend to be very counterproductive. I mean, let's think about it. It would be counterproductive to punch out your boss, wouldn't it? You'd like to? Maybe you would. I don't know. But that would be counterproductive. But that would be your fight response. It's also counterproductive to run away from your boss, which would be flight. Okay, so it leads to a very difficult situation that can actually be self-defeating and work against your emotional survival. So, what are the solutions? What can we do to start to reduce our stress and turn down the activity of our flight or fight response? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about what Dr. Niemark recommends. And again, you should research this topic. Get on Google and search it and read this article first that I'm discussing. But the fight or flight response represents a genetically hardwired system. We've talked about that. One thing you can do is change your external environment. Change your external environment or your reality. All right? This includes any action that you take that helps make your environment that you live in a little safer. This is one of the reasons why I'm such a big proponent of home security, because we spend so much time at home. This is why I'm such a big proponent of that. This is why I'm such a big proponent of making sure that I'm more secure when I travel. Because it's a way to help make my external environment or my reality, what's going on, a little safer. Physical safety means getting out of toxic, noisy, or hostile environment. If you are in a toxic, noisy, or hostile environment, I beg you, please get out of it. You don't know me. So all you know is I'm just some guy that gets on the internet, uses a microphone, produces a podcast, and puts it up on iTunes for you guys to listen to it. For all you know, who am I? I'm just saying you're one of my internet friends, okay? And I'm talking to you like a friend. I'm talking to you even though you're an internet friend and I haven't met most of you. I'm talking to you as if you were a personal friend of mine. Physical safety means getting out of a toxic, noisy, or hostile environment. If you're in one of those environments, please get out. I'm not saying you have to get out permanently, but until hostilities calm down, please get out. Emotional safety means surrounding ourselves with friends and people who genuinely care for us. All right, I'll say that again. I believe that you're a big product of your environment. My mentor, Tom Hopkins, taught me that. You are a product of your environment, folks. You will become a lot like the company you keep, or you will be affected by the company you keep. I have personally experienced this. I don't want to go into huge detail in a public setting like this, but I can tell you that once I removed myself from those toxic relationships, a lot improved for me. Emotional safety also means learning better communication skills and time management skills and getting out of the toxic jobs if you can and the hurtful relationships. Now, I understand that if you're in a toxic job, you know, jobs are not very plentiful right now. Our economy just flat out sucks right now. So you may have to just kind of learn to suck that one up a little bit. But hurtful relationships, those are not all that difficult to get out of, folks, and I would encourage that you do that. And your time management skills and your communication skills, all these things help you be a survivalist. Not a lot of people talk about this. A lot of people get on podcasts, they get on forums, they get on blogs, and they talk about all the zombie apocalypse stuff, and they talk about what happens if we have total government collapse, and they talk about what happens if we have a complete collapse of our financial system, and we have disorder, and we have disarray, and we have civil disobedience and all that, or if a hurricane comes in and wipes out an entire city. That's all good stuff to talk about, I understand. And I prepare for those things, folks. I really do. I do prepare for those things. But my percentage of importance that I place on those things is much smaller than the percentage of importance that I place on everyday things like I'm talking about here in this episode. Because the everyday things affect me more. Would you agree with me on that? Don't they affect you more? It's going to affect you more often than some of the stuff that only has a 5% chance of happening. So why do people put so much of their time preparing for the 5% and not for the 90 or 95% of the stuff that I'm talking about here on this podcast? That's kind of what's always amazed me. And so my approach to survivalism might be a little bit different than some of the other people that you hear, because I take a practical, everyday approach to it. I hope that you find that that's worth it to you, and I hope that you find that you get something out of it as well. And continuing on with this article, spiritual safety means creating a life surrounded with a sense of purpose and a relationship with a higher power and a resolve to release deeply held feelings of shame, worthlessness, and excessive guilt. All of these things help change your environment. I promise you, changing your environment will help you stay out of that fight or flight mode. Again, sometimes it's a good thing. If you really are being attacked and your life really is in danger, trust me, your body will go into fight or flight, and you'll use those abilities to get out of it. I'm talking about right now how to keep it from getting out of control. Okay, another thing you can do is to change your perception of reality. Here's what he means by that. Here's what Dr. Niemark means by that. It includes any technique whereby we seek to change our mental perspectives, change our attitudes, and change our beliefs, and change our emotional reactions to the events that happen to us. Okay, and they include things like cognitive restructuring, voice dialogue therapy, inner child work, learning not to take things personally. Oh boy, isn't that a big one? Learning not to take things personally. I need to work on that one. And there's also affirmations and self-parenting. Changing your perception of reality is best illustrated by this proverbial saying. You've heard it many times. The proverbial saying, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Without actually changing our reality, we can alter our perception of the reality. We can view difficult life events as things that make us stronger. That which does not kill us only makes us stronger, correct? Now, here's another technique to hold down some of the counterproductive responses in the fight or flight mode. Physical exercise. Here's something not talked about much. Hey, by the way, I got an email from Spencer Baker recently. And Mr. Baker, if you're listening, we need to get together and talk on Skype some more and make some podcasts out of it. Please contact me. He was deployed in the military for quite some time, and I think he's back. I'm not 100% sure, but he sent me an email. He wanted to hear some of he wanted me to give him some thoughts on some things that he's been studying. And if you remember, it was quite a while ago, somewhere in my first 50 episodes on this show, I believe it was, Spencer Baker and I, he's a military commander. We talked. He's a fitness instructor in the military. And we talked about some phenomenal ideas on physical exercise. And it kind of ties right into the point that I'm talking about. Perhaps the simplest, best way to turn down the activity of our fight or flight response is with physical exercise. And in this article, Dr. Niemark says, remember that the natural conclusion of fight or flight is vigorous physical activity, right? That's what your body sometimes does. It engages in some very vigorous physical activity. When your body goes into that, oh my God, fight or flight, I need to fight, all of a sudden you become intensely physical, do you not? So once again, that natural conclusion, the natural response is vigorous physical activity. So when you exercise, you metabolize that excessive stress, and you metabolize the excessive stress hormones that are going through your body, and you restore your body to and your mind to a much calmer and much more relaxed state. This is why exercise is so important. Even if you exercise, maybe not to lose weight, but just to relieve stress. You know, I mean, maybe you don't have any weight to lose. I do. I got to get rid of 25 or 30 pounds again. I find myself in that position again as I dictate this podcast. Let's see, today's what? Today's the 29th of November, 2011. I got 25 or 30 pounds to get rid of, unfortunately. But I'll admit it. I'll go ahead and I'll admit it to you right now. But also, exercising helps me to relieve stress. My problem is not that I don't exercise enough or I'm not active enough. My problem is I shove too much down my throat. That's my problem, and I got to watch that. But when we exercise, we do metabolize the excessive stress hormones, and it restores our body to a lot calmer and a lot more relaxed state. So for the purposes of stress reduction and counteracting that fight or flight response, exercise. But it doesn't really necessarily have to be a 30 to 40 minute or 1 hour workout. See, a lot of people think, oh, Bob, you're telling me to go work out just because I'm nervous and I'm stressed out, go work out for an hour. Well, I mean, if you can go work out for an hour and it won't kill you and you can do that on a regular basis, good for you. But if you can't do that, you don't have to do that to mitigate the fight or flight problems. Any form of activity where you just work up a sweat for about 5 minutes, that'll effectively metabolize off and prevent the excessive buildup of the stress hormones. So just get down and do 15, 20 push-ups or 50 push-ups and 50 sit-ups. You know, whatever you can handle. If it's 20 and 20, or if it's 25 and 25, or if it's 10 and 10 and run in place for 2 or 3 minutes or something like that, or do some jumping jacks or jump some rope or go up and down the stairs 4 or 5 times. Whatever, you know, works up a sweat for you. If you're staying in a hotel, go up and down the hotel stairs. If you work in a building that has stairs, you know, go up and down 2 or 3 flights of stairs at a pretty brisk pace. And do that a couple of times until you work up a sweat for about 5 or 6 minutes. That will burn off those stress hormones that have been released. All you have to do is just exercise to the point of sweating. Once you do that, you effectively counteract all the ill effects of the fight or flight response. Okay, exercise increases your natural endorphins. It helps you to feel better. And when we feel good, see, here's the cumulative benefit. When you start to feel better, your thoughts are clearer and your positive beliefs are much more accessible and your perceptions are much more open. I like to use my lunch hours as my workout time. Today I didn't get to do that because today I had to leave the house about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I had to start driving because I have an appointment to get to. I'm going way down to McAllen, Texas, folks, driving from San Antonio down to the far southern tip of Texas, not far from the Mexican border, to McAllen, Harlingen. So I had to leave so I could get to an appointment on time. So I didn't get a chance to use my lunch hour as a workout, but I'll work out before dinner tonight. But the goal of this, the reason why, let me tell you why I do that. The reason why I make my lunch hour my workout time is because usually by lunchtime, some stress is hitting me already. Right? Usually, hey, does that happen to any of you? By about lunch hour, you're like, uh-oh, man, I'm getting kind of stressed out here. My natural stress hormones are starting to hit my body right about now. So it's a great break in my day. I work out. Sometimes it's maybe only a 15 or 20 minute workout. And then I change clothes and I get back to work. And I'm refreshed. I feel fresher. I feel more positive. I can think more clearly. Effectively, what I've done, I've taken my body out of that fight or flight mode that I've been in because of the stimulators, because of the stress stimulators. So you might want to think about that. And when we start to feel tired and we start to get physically run down, we tend to focus on what's not working in our lives. We tend to focus on all the bad stuff at that point. And that's not good. It's not good at all. It's kind of like a cranky kid who needs a nap. They start focusing on all the negative stuff, don't they? So it's difficult to be or feel or think positive when you're exhausted or you're sleep deprived or you're just physically out of condition. Even if you can do 15 minutes a day, you'd be amazed. Do 15 minutes a day for 30 days. If you're not a big exerciser, if you're not someone who's really worked out much, if you're not somebody who stays real fit, just try 10 or 15 minutes every day for 30 days. Make that commitment. See if I'm wrong. I guarantee you, you'll feel some positive effects from it. Okay, so quick review before I move on to the next topic. What can you do to reduce the stress and turn down the activity of your fight or flight response? I talked about changing your actual environment, getting out of the relationships or getting out of the actual physical environment that you happen to be in that's causing the problems. And then I talked about changing your perception of reality. A little bit of self-talk, folks, never hurts. A little bit of self-talk. Silently, of course. Make sure you do it silently. If you talk to yourself out loud, people might think you're a little weird. But a little self-talk really does help, folks. It's major. You know, sometimes it's time to do a checkup from the neck up and start training your brain, is what I'm trying to say. And then physical exercise. Just try those three simple things. When you feel yourself going into that fight or flight, and you'll feel it because your rational thought will start to go out the window. You'll start to get sensitive. You'll start to get cranky. You'll start to get irritable. You might start to get violent. Of course, I hope not. I hope you're not that kind of person. But if you are, try these three simple things and see if it makes a difference. Because again, you know, survival is psychological. You've got to be psychologically fit to survive in order to actually survive. And I really believe that. Okay? So hopefully this little study, this little exploration that I just went into on the fight or flight response based on Dr. Neil Neumark's excellent article, which you got to go read it, folks. It's a lengthy article, but it's well worth the read. Again, I covered some of it in this segment. I didn't even begin to touch all of it. But hopefully I've whet your appetite to read that and digest it, because I think it's very good. It's an article that I found on the internet when I was researching this topic of fight or flight, and I think it's really good. So check that out. Now, let's take a quick break. Just real quick, you'll just hear a short little amount of music here, and then I'll come back with some listener comments. Don't go away. Okay, back with you. This segment is going to be dedicated to some comments I recently received. Now, I do get a lot of email. I want to tell you, I get a ton of it. And it's good. It's great. I really love it. As a matter of fact, I'd love to get some audio comments from you. I get a lot of those on the Handgun World show. I get a lot of people recording stuff and sending it to me. And I play every one of them on the show. And I'd be happy to play yours. As long as it doesn't contain any profanity or anything like that, I'll be happy to play it. And you don't have to agree with me on everything. You know, I mean, there have been people who have sent me some audio comments on my other show that don't agree. That's fine. That's okay. I'm an open-minded guy, folks. So I encourage disagreement. I think it makes for very good discussion, and it makes for very good objective thought. And some people do agree with me, and some people just want to add to what I've said. It's all good stuff. So if you want to send me an email, or if you want to send me an audio comment, which would even be more preferred, if you have an iPhone or you have a Droid phone, you can record some voice memos on there, and then you can send those to me and email those to me. Or you can just use different programs on your computer. Almost all laptops have a built-in microphone. There's a free program called Audacity. You can download Audacity, and you can put it into record mode, and you can record a voice memo to me that way. And don't worry, it can be in any format. It can be in any format you want, even in WAV format, whatever. You can send it to me. I can always convert it and use it on the show. But what I'm going to cover right now are emails that came to me. And I'm sorry I can't get to every single one. I get so many of them, folks, that if I were to answer every single email, I would end up doing about 15 podcasts with nothing but listener email. It's not that I don't appreciate what you guys send. It's just that I really don't have time to work every single one of them into the show. So please accept my apology if I don't directly talk about your email that you sent to me on the show. But I picked out a few here that I thought were really good. So let's talk about them. The first one comes from Greg in Minnesota. Now, Greg is also known as Jack Pine Savage on the forum. Greg's actually done some interviews with me, a couple of them. If you go back and listen to some of my older shows, we did some pretty good interviews, and I'm just going to kind of let you go back and find them. Read the comments. Read the comments underneath each show posting, and you'll see them. But Greg writes to me, he says, "Bob, I was listening to the Handgun World show episode where a listener named Jason wanted to know what body armor was like." Now, Greg is in law enforcement in Minnesota. And he, you know, if you've ever wondered, and this is, you know, this isn't really in the same topic line as my fight or flight subject for this episode, but I felt this was important to cover anyway. If you've ever wondered what it's like to wear body armor for self-defense and should you do it, listen to this. Greg says, "I've worn body armor for about 30 years. It can be best described as taking a couple of pieces of carpet sample, cutting them into a vest shape, wrapping them in a garbage bag, and then duct taping them onto your body." Wow. He says it's hot, it's not flexible, regardless of what the manufacturer says, and it's uncomfortable. He said, "The best I've had was Second Chance's Monarch armor in a t-shirt carrier. It had about 3 inches of gap on the 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock positions, and it would breathe a little bit. And that was the most flexible he had ever seen. Second Chance used to make a fanny pack that held a front plate and then folded down into it, but he hasn't seen it for over 10 years, he said. He says, "And oh yeah, if you get knocked to the ground in body armor, you're kind of like a turtle, and it's no fun getting up. It does help against a punch or other impact, and like other insurance, you don't want to use it if you have to, but if you need it, you've got it." So, hey, Greg, thanks for that description. Man, I never thought of that. Woo! That stuff's got to be uncomfortable. I feel sorry for law enforcement people that have to wear those. I mean, I understand it's a necessity. And like you say, like you close your email, Greg, hey, you know what? You hope you never have to use it, but you wear it in case you need it. It's the same reason why a lot of people who are into common sense survival carry guns if they're legally allowed to do so where they live. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop, like I say on my other show. I carry a gun in case I have to need it. I carry a gun every day, folks, because I don't want to use it. I hope I don't have to use it, but if I need it, it's there. It's a form of insurance. Okay? Good comment, Greg. Good description of wearing body armor. Wow. Thanks. Now, another comment came to me from a gentleman named David, and I don't know where he's from. He does comment a lot. He actually put this comment on the main website, todayssurvival.com, under the show posting, where you can always put comments there as well. And I believe it's on episode 161 where I talked about vehicle safety. It's the episode on vehicle safety. Again, I'm driving and I want to go trying to look that up right now, but I'm pretty sure it was episode 161. And I want to tell you that David is a police officer, okay? And I'm pretty sure that he lives in Alabama. Now, David says, Bob, this was an interesting episode, but I was disturbed to hear the shift of focus from the criminals to the police in your discussion about rolling down the window. It seemed like you were equating criminals and police officers. I understand the concern about retaining privacy rights, but it seemed like you were giving tips on how to hide criminal behavior. As a police officer, if someone only rolls down the window a few inches, I wonder, well, what are they trying to hide? Are they trying to keep me from smelling the odor of illegal drugs or alcohol? Although bad officers unfortunately exist, the majority believe in constitutionally protected freedoms and are not trying to harass law-abiding citizens. It seemed out of character for you to take this stance, Bob. What were your thoughts behind those comments? So, let me address this. I may have miscommunicated. I typed him a response, by the way, and I put the response on the website at todayssurvival.com. You can go check that out. Again, I believe it's episode 161. And you can read those comments if you wish. And by the way, like I said, I always encourage disagreements like this, or if you want to challenge something I said, this is good. This is good because without this, it's hard to have good, intelligent back and forth dialogue. Here's my response to Officer David. Perhaps I've miscommunicated. I do completely respect police officers, and I respect the job they do, and I understand that they're not paid enough for what they do. My intent is that there are only a handful of bad police officers. I understand that. But there are also people who impersonate police officers. And although they're rare, they do exist. If a law-abiding citizen has nothing to hide, well, then guess what? Then there's nothing to hide, and that will come out later. But it doesn't mean that a law-abiding citizen is obligated to opening up their vehicle freely for a search. I should have restated that rolling down your window all the way is okay, but if the officer asks you to exit the vehicle, it might be wise to roll your window all the way up, exit the vehicle, close and lock the door behind you. That way you're proceeding with the officer's request. You've complied, but you've not freely opened yourself for a search. If the law-abiding citizen has nothing to hide, then the officer will find nothing eventually. I just don't want to risk running into the one cop who's having a real bad day and wants to take it out on me. Or I don't want to risk running into the one cop who's really not a cop. Or the bad cops, as you point out. And again, I'm not trying to bash cops, please. I'm really not trying to bash cops. I respect police officers. I respect the fact that police officers put their lives on the line every day to try to protect us. But understanding a person's Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure is also important. And what I was trying to point out in that episode when I talked about that is that you do have rights. You do have constitutional rights. You have constitutionally protected rights. And even though you might kind of give off the impression that you're trying to hide something, in my opinion, so be it. Officer David, let me tell you, I am not trying to encourage criminal behavior. I'm not trying to support criminal behavior. I understand an officer, if I rolled my window down 4 or 5 inches, handed him my driver's license, if I'm stopped, my driver's license and proof of insurance, yeah, he might get suspicious. If he gets suspicious, okay, fine. Then he gets suspicious. If I'm not hiding anything, he'll search my vehicle if I allow him to. And guess what? He'll find nothing. But I don't see the reason in, and a lot of people make this mistake. I don't see the reason in voluntarily making you and your vehicle real easy to inspect. We have privacy rights. It's no one's business what I have in my car. It doesn't mean I have something illegal in my car. I'll state that again. It doesn't mean I have something illegal in my car, but on the off chance that that police officer is having a bad day, it's none of his business what's in my car. And yes, there are bad apples. There are bad apples everywhere. And sometimes there are bad cops who do things that aren't real scrupulous. That's not all of them. So if you're a police officer like Officer David and you're listening to this, please, I'm not trying to bash you. I'm not trying to say that, I'm not pointing a finger at you saying that you are the problem, but there are others out there who are a problem. And as a survivalist, as a common sense survivalist, one that understands my constitutional rights, I do not wish, if I can help it, to subject myself to people I don't know. I don't know a police officer who pulls me over. I don't know him from Adam. He doesn't know me from Adam. Automatically, there's going to be some suspicion, right? If I'm pulled over by a police officer, again, I've never been a cop, but I can take a pretty good guess here. If you're a police officer and you pull somebody over, you don't know them, most likely. You're probably going to be suspicious, are you not? Well, it works both ways. Sometimes the person being pulled over gets suspicious as well. There are reports of people faking to be cops, pulling over women and raping them and killing them. That's happened more times than we all care to admit, ladies and gentlemen. So, I hope I've made myself clear. I might have miscommunicated. And it may seem like that I was trying to encourage people to hide criminal behavior. I'm sorry if I miscommunicated that. That is certainly not my intent. It was not my intent with the comments that I made on that episode on vehicle survival. But again, if a person's a criminal and they're doing something criminal or they have something criminal in their vehicle, well then you, the police officer, are probably going to search them and you're going to find the criminal problem, you're going to find what they're carrying, you're going to find the drugs or the alcohol that they have, and you're going to arrest them and you're going to do your job. And if there's nothing going on, you're either going to let me go free, or maybe you might decide that you want to check me out and you'll find nothing and I'll move along. Okay? But it's not a chance I'm willing to take to completely open myself up voluntarily for anybody, police officer or not, to basically invade my privacy space and look around at will at whatever they want. So that's my point, and I hope that it didn't come across too bad, and I hope that I clarify myself. And David, thank you for sending me that. I very much appreciate your comments, and I appreciate you as a listener to both shows very much. Now, another listener put a comment on episode 166, I believe, the last one I just did on non-lethal self-defense weapons, or less than lethal. Somebody corrected me and said, Bob, you shouldn't call them non-lethal because everything you talked about in that episode could kill someone. And you know what? They're right. So I should have titled that show Less Lethal Self-Defense Weapons. And I talked about flashlights in that episode, and this listener writes to me, or he put a comment on the main website. He said, not to attack you, you have a wealth of information, but I don't think you focused enough on the blinding power of a flashlight, Bob. The range is unlimited, and imagine a few gangbangers at a small distance. If they manage to get up on you, they're going to see spots if you blind them with your flashlight. Even in the daytime, a flashlight with enough lumens can leave somebody blinded for a short time, giving you time to escape. He said, you did mention using it as a club, so thumbs up. Some flashlights have two modes. You're outside with the low mode, plenty to see by, and an attacker charges you one click and flash. They cannot see anything, and they're at your mercy. Very good point, sir. I didn't elaborate enough on flashlights, and you just did that for me. Thank you. Yes, the blinding effect of a good flashlight, a good quality flashlight, with enough lumens to basically blind somebody for a while, that is a defensive tool. And I may have underestimated that, or I may have understated that when I was talking about using a flashlight as a less lethal self-defense tool. So, very good point, sir. Thank you. And again, let me restate. I like using flashlights. I like carrying them with the crenulated bezel, with the teeth on the bezel by the light. Now, those are kind of controversial. Some people say, well, you know, it looks like you're carrying something for self-defense. Well, duh. Yeah, I am. Okay? It's a good utility flashlight, but yeah, I am carrying something for self-defense. And it's not illegal to carry. Right now, as I talk to you, I have a gun on my hip for self-defense. And here in the great state of Texas, it's not illegal for me to carry it, as long as I have a permit and a license from the state to do so. So I carry what I can to protect myself within the law. So that's why I like to use those flashlights with a crenulated bezel. But it can be used to bludgeon somebody with, or to hit them, or to you can use it as a coubaton, even if it doesn't have those teeth on the front of it. Whatever suits your fancy. But yeah, I appreciate this listener pointing out the fact that just the light itself, if it's bright enough, can be a great self-defense tool. Thank you. Okay, well, I think I've kind of gone on long enough here on this episode. I hope that you got something out of the fight or flight. And I really hope that next time you find yourself in that situation, that you'll remember a couple of things from this podcast. And maybe that fight or flight response might serve you well someday. And maybe what I've covered might help you to control it. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and bring this episode to a close. I'm Bob Main, and you've just listened to another episode of today's Survival Show, where it's my goal to help you do what you can with what you have, wherever you are. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'll catch you next time.
You're listening to Free Music by Dano. Download free MP3s at danosongs.com.